Well, good evening. It's good to be gathered like this again on another evening for revivals. Last evening, we talked a little bit, thinking about kind of going back to the garden, thinking about God's love for us, his desire that he would take first place in our life. And this evening, I would like to talk a little bit more about love, but in this case, talk what it means to love other people. Think about when the lawyer came to Jesus, asking, what is the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets, right? And so those two things kind of summarize all the law and the prophets. And so this evening, I'd like to look a little bit about what it means to forgiving and loving like Christ. Now, back in September, I received an email. And to give you a little context to this email, I need to go back, probably 10, 15 years here. I went to college as an engineer, and I had worked studying biodiesel and seed pressing, actually. And so there was a missionary in sub-Saharan Africa, in Burkina Faso, that was working among the Burkinabe people, and would have liked some help or would like some assistance in trying to figure out how to press oil out of Jatropha seeds. It was a type of weed or plant that grew naturally there. It was poisonous. And if you understand a little bit about Burkina Faso and sub-Saharan Africa, this was out in a very remote place. There was no electricity. Any type of electricity you had there was from solar panels and things like that. And so the idea was, is could we somehow get a way to have fuel way back in? And so the idea was, is if we could generate, we could press the oil out of the Jatropha seeds, we could make biodiesel, we could run generators, we could begin to power things there. And so we got to know Matt and Julie Walsh through that event. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't successful, what we were trying to do. But some time passed. And unfortunately, radical Islam went through the country of Burkina Faso. They had a medical clinic there. They had a handicap center or a center for the people that had disabilities. These radical Islamic extremists kind of came through. They burnt the handicap clinic, and it wasn't even safe. So they moved and continued serving in the country of Senegal. So we get periodic updates and things from them. And in here in September, around September 18th, we received an email, and it was about Julie, Matt's wife Julie. She had stepped out on the back porch where they typically do their laundry and felt a sting in her right foot. And she immediately thought, well, she must have stepped on a scorpion. Scorpions are pretty common in that area of the world. And she looked over to see a black cobra slithering away. Well, if you know anything about snakes, that was not a good thing. And so they immediately, Matt took her to the hospital. They immediately started giving her anti-venom. And by the end of the day, her legs started to swell up. She began feeling weaker. They kept giving her more anti-venom, trying to combat the snake venom. By the end of the day, she was feeling very weak. Her muscles felt heavy. So they gave her some more anti-venom on Friday, trying to turn this thing around. And finally, on Saturday, she started gaining some energy and was able to eat a little bread, drink some juice and things, and things started to turn around. And so over the next few days, we were receiving emails from her husband, Matt, on how she was doing. And finally, on September 23rd, we received the update that they were able to go home from the hospital. And so it was exciting time, a blessing to see that she was able to pull through that. Now, I had been studying for revivals well before revivals, praying about it and everything, so this was back in September. I literally just got an email yesterday, which I wasn't expecting. She is flying to the United States. There's an infection in the wound, and they're going to do whatever they need to do to take care of that, do a skin graft. It is not completely over yet. And so they're actually flying her home to get that additional medical treatment. As I was thinking about that story, My mind went back to Genesis 3:15. This is kind of where we were last evening. This was God speaking to the serpent. He said, "And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." And so she got bit like right in the heel, right in that right foot area. And so my mind went to that. And I realized that's a prophetic reference to Christ. We understand how Christ came. He was bruised for our iniquities. He was chastised. He suffered. He died. We could say his heel was, in essence, bruised. But he rose from the grave. He rose victorious over death and sin. And he, we could say, bruised the head of the snake, conquered death, right? And yet what God was saying to that snake, that serpent, was not only a prophetic reference to Christ, but is also what we deal with today with snakes sometimes. I mean, this account with Julie is a prime example of that. That black cobra bit Julie's foot, and that snake was later hunted down and killed. And they had a picture of it, machete chopped up, there it laid. It was dead. However, in all this, it's a reminder to me about how serious snake bites can be. Now, I'm glad we don't have black cobras slithering around here. Now, that would just, I would have to get used to that. You know, Julie could have easily lost her life had she not received the appropriate medical treatment quickly enough. I mean, it really threw her back. And I was surprised. I didn't realize, I don't know much about black cobras, but it was serious. And as I pondered all this, it reminded me of life. You know, there are things that come into our lives that are extremely difficult. And I don't know what all you're facing. I don't know each one of you individually. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what you're facing or what you have come through. People can be very hurtful in their actions and their words. Sometimes we get hurt by the people that are closest to us. And these hurts can leave deep scars. And yet, even when we have been hurt deeply, Christ has given us a way to overcome. Even when we've been hurt deeply, when people talk badly about us, talk behind our back, or we go through a real difficult time, Christ has given us the power to overcome. And he longs to redeem the situations in our lives for his honor and glory. He longs for that. You know, so many times we look at the issues in life and we immediately go to the people. It's the people's fault. Whatever, the person who caused us the pain. I go back to COVID and some of the decisions that were made over that time. There were a lot of people that spoke very negatively about our government leaders. I'm not saying what they did was correct or they handled the situation properly, but we're called to respect our leaders. So many times when we look at when things are in turmoil and things are, we just feel maybe agitated or hurt, we can blame the people. It's an easy out. It's like a scapegoat, right? We focus on the people that are involved. You know, the person that cut me off entering the merge point, in a construction zone. People that gossip behind our back, can be anybody. And yet, this is just on the surface. This is just on the surface. There's a spiritual war going on behind the scenes, and we're in this battle as well. Let us not lose the spiritual battles in our own life by getting caught up on the fray that's on the surface, the friction, the tension that can sometimes bubble to the top. You know, I'm reminded of the story of Job. We all know that story very well. And we look at that story. You know, he lost his family. He lost basically everything he owned in a day. Then he came down with boils, painful as could be. And then to have his wife turn to him and say, "Curse God and die." He didn't even have support. You talk about a low point in your life. Why, God? Why would you allow this to happen? He was completely oblivious to the dialogue that was going on in heaven between God and Satan. "Have you seen my servant Job? How he's an upright man. Perfect." He didn't see that. He didn't understand that. He was just seeing the surface. And the same way it is in our lives. So many times we don't understand. We do not see. We won't see. And we probably will never know until we get to eternity why we went through what we went through. Yet each trial is an opportunity for Christ to be honored and glorified through our life. And so we need to be living like Christ. We need to be forgiving and loving others like Christ did. Now, back when I was in college, I was required to take several general education courses as part of the overall package deal there as getting a degree from the college. And so, yeah, we had to fill something out. And so I'm looking over all the courses, and I don't know what prompted me or I don't know what I was thinking, but I signed up for a class on the Holocaust. I don't know if I was knocking out a gen ed for history or what it was, but I was trying to get something out of the way, so I checked Holocaust, and I was enrolled in the class on the Holocaust. And it was probably about the worst class I took in college. Now, it's not because we could say the course was really hard. You showed up to class, you did your work, you studied hard, you were okay. It was not because the professor didn't know what he was talking about. It was actually quite the opposite. He was the author of the textbook. He was very knowledgeable. But it was because of the content. You know, I would routinely be going through my day, and I'm a fairly jovial person. I mean, don't walk around with my head down too often. And I would go through that class in the afternoon, and I would come out depressed. It was just awful. It wasn't like it wasn't good to learn or wrestle with, but it was just hard to process. How could human beings treat others that way? Families being torn apart, having people starve in concentration camps. How could other humans do this? People being herded into large trenches, forced to lay down on top of piles of dead corpses and then just gunned down. Why? How? How is this possible? Men and women and children being forced into gas chambers and killed. How do you process that? How can that much evil exist? It was very depressing. And in the last class, or one of the last classes of the semester, we got to talking about how many Jews became atheists. And so if you look at this whole picture here of them going through the Holocaust, many of these Jews that came out the other side could not believe in God or could not believe in a loving God. How could a loving God allow them to face these difficult times? And then the professor asked this question, could you believe in God if you lived through the Holocaust? You were there, you saw your family die, you were starving in a concentration camp. Could you wrestle through that? Would your faith stand up to that? Could you believe in God? I invite you to Matthew 5 this evening. We're going to look at verses 38 to 48. This is the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is talking about how we treat other people, and specifically those who mistreat us. So I'll read verses 38 through the end of the chapter, but we're going to be focusing on loving our enemies there in verses 43 through 48. So I'll start at verse 38, though, because it gives some good context. Verse 38, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor, and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth the rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." So if we look at verses 43 and 44, and also we can see this in verse 38 and 39 too, we see this common phrase as we go through the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, "Ye have heard that it hath been said," and he quotes the Old Testament law. Then he comes back to it and say, "But I say unto you." And so he keeps referring back to the Jewish law and then expounds on the new covenant that he was ushering in, what this was going to look like. And so he was not tearing down the law, but he was building upon it. He was going beyond it. He was getting to what we could call the heart or the spirit of the law, God's heart behind the law. In the Old Testament, the Jews were commanded to love their neighbor and hate certain of their enemies. And so when I looked this up in my cross-reference here in my Bible, it brought up Deuteronomy 12:23-6. It was talking about the Amorites and talking about the Moabites. And it says, "Thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all the days forever." And I was like, oh, I can't believe it. I'm just trying to think, well, why would God have said that? But I was like, oh, the Moabites, yes. We go back to the story of Balaam and how the Moabites led the children into sin. They led them into sin. And so we see God telling them they were not supposed to seek their peace. Then in Leviticus 19:18, it says, "Thou shalt not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am Jehovah." And so here, as we look at the context of my neighbor, right, they're talking about, or it could be interpreted as fellow Jews, the children of thy people. These Jews were not to seek vengeance or hold a grudge against any of their own people group, their neighbors. Now, this can be difficult, especially when other people are difficult to deal with, especially when they don't treat us kindly. And yet, even with this being difficult, Jesus takes it a step further and says that we're supposed to love our enemies. Now, that word enemies, it's not like it's some kind of, the King James doesn't have it right, or whatever. It's taken from the Greek word ekthros. It means hateful or to hate. It's somebody that is not looking out for your well-being, somebody that hates you. And love in that verse is agape love. It's a Christ-like love. It's the love that we see in Romans 5:8. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And so this love is not natural, cannot be lived out consistently without the Spirit of God living in one's life. Now, there are three basic ways we can respond to our enemies. Three ways. The first way, or you could maybe say four, but the first way is we can return hate for hate. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And that kind of kept things in check, right? Equal for equal. And we could maybe lump into this category, or taking it a step further to revenge. Two eyes for one eye. Two teeth for one tooth. That idea. This is kind of this unbridled natural response. Like, I am going to get even, or I am going to take vengeance, right? I'm going to get revenge. This is the way the children respond. You know, maybe they have a toy. You have two children there, they're playing, and they look over, and it's like, oh, that's my doll. So you go over, and the child grabs the leg and starts pushing, and then the one starts pushing the other child, and it just keeps escalating, and there's hollering, and that's the unbridled natural response coming through. The Old Testament law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth kept this in check. It didn't let it run out of control. A second way we can respond is to simply not respond to the hateful act. I would call this the bridled natural response. It's the way that adults should respond, even if they're living in their own human nature, since this is the behavior and courage in general society, for the most part. Nobody likes when people are, you know, creating road rage and blowing up and whatever else. Yes, people are going to cut you off. Some things are going to happen. Things aren't going to be nice. But just cool it, relax, and move on, right? And so non-Christians can live this out. They're able to exhibit a level of self-control in the way they respond, even though they may not feel that way inwardly. And so it's frustrating, and yet they have enough of self-control that it doesn't blow up. This response keeps the tensions from escalating. Now, too often when I look at my own life, too many times, I am satisfied with this level of response. I did my thing. I didn't go talk behind the other guy's back now or spread some rumors, or I didn't do this or that or to kind of get even. I just bit my lips and I'm good. I showed Jesus. And I'm okay at this level. I feel good about operating at this level. However, this is not the level of response that Christ requires of his followers. What he is asking is that we return good for hate. This is a Christ-like response. And the world will not understand this behavior. You know, this type of response builds bridges. It seeks reconciliation. It pushes towards that. It is representing or showing a godlike love. We could say an agape love, an aggressive love for the other person. It has this eternal perspective on the person's soul. Do you care about the perpetrator to the point that you will aggressively love them? I care about them. And so it's not a passive love. You know, we think of God as love. When we look at God as love, he sent Jesus, and he pursued us. He pursued us. It's an aggressive love, not a passive love. And so when we love our enemies, we return good for hate, others experience the love of God through us. Now, verse 44 lays out three actions that would fall under this concept of loving our enemies. The first is that we bless them that curse you. You know, words can really hurt. They can really hurt. It can leave a lot of damage. People can be scarred for years. Each one of us can probably remember times when unkind things were said, when we were hurt by someone else's words. However, it's our choice on how we respond to this, how we are going to respond to this. We can return hateful comment for hateful comment. We could just zip our lips and eat it and just kind of maybe fester or boil inside. Or we can choose to move forward in aggressive love and bless them as they make hateful comments about us. We are to do good to them that hate you. You know, we cannot choose how people treat us. We go through life, things come up, things are going to happen. We do not have control of the events that come into our lives. God's in control, but we don't have that control. You know, some time ago at work, we would go over this equation. It was the event plus your response equals the outcome, positive or negative. There's only one part of that equation that you have any control over, and that's your response. But your response has a direct effect on the outcome, okay? Whether it's positive or negative. God is a redemptive God. You know, he brought life out of death. Christ's death on the cross was an awful event. And yet God used it to bring life to each one of us. And so in a similar manner, God longs to redeem the times that are meant to bring death to us, that are meant to bring us down, to bring him honor and glory, to bring life. And yet we play a part in this redemptive work. You know, we have a choice in how we respond. Are we going to allow God to work through us, or are we going to respond in a different manner? Just like Jesus wrestled in the garden in prayer, struggling, sweating drops of blood as he anticipated going to the cross. He laid his life down. That struggle between the flesh and the spirit, we have the same struggle within us. You know, sometimes we think, well, Jesus was just going to go to the cross. That was it. You know, that he understood so clearly. And yet the flesh was in there bucking the whole way. There was nothing pretty about it. And so we still have that struggle within us. And yet when the spiritual victory is won, and we get through to the other side, the beauty that comes forth out of the struggle is more beautiful than had we not gone through that event or that struggle at all. You know, so many times we want to shy away from the difficult times in our life. So many times we want to pull back. We don't like conflict. We don't like things coming up. We want to pull back. And yet God longs to redeem those times in our lives. Are you willing to do good to those who hate you? It comes down to an everyday choice in life. It's a choice we make. And then finally there in verse 44, it talks about praying for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. You know, one of the clearest pictures I see in Scripture of this is when Jesus was hanging on the cross. In Luke 23:34, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. Another example would be Stephen in Acts 7:60. When he kneeled down, he cried with a loud voice, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. And you can look back and you can read the martyr's mirror and you see examples as well of people praying for the exact same people that are trying to kill them, that are trying to bring death. To sincerely request that God would forgive those who are in the process of killing you is displaying a love that does not come naturally. You have to see past the person. You have to see past the facade, the surface, to the person's soul. It is a godlike love, an agape love, an aggressive love that is concerned about the perpetrator's soul. It has an eternal perspective. Now in verse 45, Jesus says that this way of living is necessary if we want to be considered child of God. You know, sometimes we think, well, man, this is optional. This is just for the spiritual elite, the people that are up here. No, if you want to be considered a child of God, this is what we're told to do. The Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, is for here and now, to be lived out today. It says that ye may be the children of your Father. And so it gives this example of how God blesses all people. It talks about how he sends sunshine and rain on both the good and the evil. God's not partial. He treats everybody the same. So just because you're following the Lord, doesn't mean you're going to be super blessed over here. And just because this guy is doing evil over here, doesn't mean he's going to be cursed and damned and whatever else. This isn't the health and wealth gospel. Now, there is art, like I think we talked about this last night, intrinsic benefits for following God's path, his design for life. And yet God blesses all people. There are many people that are extremely financially blessed in this world that are not probably following God's plan for their life. You know, I don't know Elon Musk personally. I don't know Jeff Bezos personally. I don't know anything about them, so I don't have anything to say really about them personally. I'd be looking on the outside, it would say I question whether they're following God's design for life, for their lives, but these people are extremely blessed. Elon Musk has a net worth of $480 billion. It's hard for us to even imagine $1 billion or $1 million, or, I mean, keep ratcheting it down. We can't even fathom that amount of net worth. It's, you know, Jeff Bezos, $228 billion. God blesses all people, right? He's not partial to anyone, and so we need to follow his example. Just the worst of sinners, God still blesses. If we go to verses 46 and 47, Jesus continues this thought. We're called to love everyone. There's no reward in just loving those who love us. Good for good, right? You're my friend, therefore I will treat you as a friend. You're my enemy, I'm going to keep you at arm's distance, arm's length. And Jesus brings in this idea of the publicans, the tax collectors. They were hated of the Jewish people. Think of how they sometimes took more than what they were required to for the Roman taxes. We know the story of Zacchaeus. He's a little dishonest. I'm sure many of the other tax collectors were as well. They got a name, and rightfully so. And yet they had friends, and they showed kindness to their friends. And so if we only show kindness to our friends, only those who do not mistreat us, those who treat us kindly, we're no different than the world around us. And finally, in verse 48 then, Jesus calls us to be perfect. Now, I don't know what, anybody here perfect? I'm joking. You know, I don't think any of us would be the first ones to say, yeah, I'm perfect. Yep, that's me. Yeah, I'm right there, right up at the perfect level. You know, we're still in the sanctification process. The word perfect there means complete. It means whole. We're to be completely transformed into the image of Christ, represent him perfectly in life. But how do we do this when we're battling the flesh? Like, is it possible to be perfect? And I don't think, I mean, I'm not sure how you would look at this, but there's not one person on this earth that has ever lived a perfect life outside of Christ, right? So none of us have attained to this level. And I think this is where the love and the grace and mercy of God come into the picture. You know, we strive, we walk in the footsteps of Christ. We are a disciple of his. We're following after him. We seek to love him in the way that we reflect him in life. But there will be times when we stumble and fall. There will be times when we battle the flesh and we come up short. We don't represent Christ the way he would like us to. We fail to accurately portray God to others. And it's in times like this that we need to ask forgiveness of our Heavenly Father. I enjoy children. I think I've mentioned that before. And sometimes it's helpful for me to think about a child that's learning to walk. We have 6 children. Every one of our children came out of the womb not knowing how to eat by themselves. They had to learn how to sleep. They had to learn how to crawl. They had to learn how to walk. They had to learn all these things. And so, okay, child's growing up around the maybe a year old or something like that. Maybe they're trying to start taking the first steps and they're kind of holding on to the edge of the sofa and they're trying to learn to walk. And so maybe we go to them and we hold their hand and we help them along and they stumble and fall and we pick them back up and we help them along and we help them walk and they stumble and fall again. So in my child, I gave them 5 times to stumble and fall and then I laid down the law. That was it. Done. Now it's discipline. No. We would never do that. If they fell 20 times, I'd pick them up 20 times. If they fell 30 times, I'd pick them up 30 times. Eventually, what happens? None of my children crawled in the door this evening. They all knew how to walk. It's wonderful. They were growing. They were learning. We're in the same, we're children just like that. We're growing. We're learning. God longs to pull his hand down and lift us back up. Walk with me. Walk with me. I'm reminded of Jesus' parable of the servant that owed this enormous debt. There's this Lord and this servant. The servant owed 10,000 talents. 10,000 talents, you couldn't pay that off in a couple lifetimes. It was impossible. And so the Lord, trying to reconcile his accounts, or I'm not sure what he was doing, realized that this guy needs to pay up. And so this servant begs for mercy. Give me a little time and I'll pay. Now that was the most ridiculous statement. He was never going to pay it back. There was just no way. And yet God forgave him. The Lord forgave him all that debt. Wiped it clean. Didn't say, okay, keep trying to pay on it, right? No, he wiped it completely clean. It was a done deal. Paid for, in full, done, and moved on. And yet this person, this servant, goes out and finds someone that owed him 100 pence. 100 pence. I like to think of that as roughly maybe a 4 months worth of income. You know, if we look at Jesus' parable of the laborers, the day laborers, some were hired in the morning, some were hired in the evening. I think they each received a pence, right? So it's kind of like a day's wages, right? So 100 days wages, 4 months, maybe a little more, somewhere in that range. It was a doable amount. You give somebody time, and they have the right effort and motivation, they could have paid it back. And yet this servant turns around, he throws the other guy into prison. Last time I checked, they don't pay very well in prison. He was in there for life. He wasn't getting out. You know, if we're not careful, we can be like this other servant, refusing to forgive, throwing other people in prison for the small mistreatments we really receive sometimes. You know, it's so important that we have a proper perspective on what Christ has done for us. We need to keep this in focus. You know, as soon as I take my focus off of what Christ has done for me, I start focusing on the wounds that I received, the hurts in my life, the mistreatment, it becomes harder and harder to forgive. Last evening we got home and we sat down for our family devotions and I opened up the book and it was on Numbers 21. It's the account of the Israelites. They're in their wilderness wanderings and they're complaining again, complaining against God, complaining against Moses. They don't have water. They're sick and tired of this manna. And God judges them. He sends these poisonous snakes, these fiery serpents, in among them, and they're biting them. People are dying. And the people are seeing their friends die, their family members die, and they've realized they had sinned. And so they go to Moses and say, call out to God, please forgive us, you know, have him stop this. And so God tells Moses to make a brass serpent, put it on a pole, put it up in the middle of the camp, and anyone who looked on that brass serpent would be healed. You know, so often times in life, we look at the wounds. We nurse our wounds. We focus on the pain that we received. Yet the real victory comes when we look to Christ. First and foremost for our salvation, but then in following in his footsteps. When we understand what he's done for us, it becomes easier for us to forgive others. Now, I felt led to share this message this evening because this was something I was personally struggling with here recently. It was a small issue, really shouldn't have meant much. I felt like I was being trampled on by others. My inner self wanted to rise up and just kind of push back. Like, I had every right. It wasn't just what was going on. And I struggled to know what to do. I became more and more frustrated as I looked at the situation. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. It wasn't just. Do I push back? Do I just be quiet and inwardly stew about what was going on? Or do I lay down my will in order to bless the other person, even though I felt like I was being completely mistreated? It was only when I redirected my focus back onto Christ, I got myself out of this situation, the Holy Spirit working in my life, that I was able to kind of get through that. It was something so small. It should have been small. It should have been nothing. And yet I was focused on the hurt. I was focused on the pain. We've been forgiven a debt that we had absolutely no way of paying, each one of us. And yet we go around placing people in prison, those who have mistreated us, those who have caused us hurt. We keep them at arm's length. We do not love them in the same way that Christ truly loved us. And yet God is calling us to love our enemies, to follow him. You know, in light of what Christ has done for us, can we do anything less? I'd like to read an excerpt from Corrie ten Boom. I'm assuming maybe some of you have probably read this. I don't know. I'm sure most of you know the story of Corrie ten Boom. When I was studying for this sermon, I was looking for an example of someone who came through the Holocaust and forgave. Because the question of whether God exists, God is love, he's an act of love, is kind of on the, you could say, kind of analogous to, could a person love? Can people love coming through such deep pain? And when I stumbled upon this story of Corrie, I was reminded again of the importance of keeping a proper focus. And so this account is, I think she's the one writing it, is it takes place several years after the war ended, and she's going around, traveling around, speaking on forgiveness. She's traveling in Europe. So I'm going to read it this time. Hopefully this can be a blessing to you. It, to me, I think is very powerful. It was in a church in Munich that I saw him. A balding, heavy-set man in a gray overcoat. A brown felt hat clutched between his hands. People were filing out of the basement room where I had just spoken. It was 1947, and I had come from Holland to defeated Germany with the message that God forgives. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment I saw the overcoat and the brown hat. The next, a blue uniform and visored cap with its skull and crossbones. It came back to me with a rush. The huge room with its harsh overhead lights. The pathetic pile of dresses and shoes in the center of the floor. The shame of walking naked past this man. I could see my sister's frail form ahead of me, ribs sharp beneath the parchment skin. Betsy, how thin you were. Betsy and I had been arrested for concealing Jews in our home during the Nazi occupation of Holland. This man had been a guard at Ravensbrück concentration camp where we had been sent. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk, he was saying. I was a guard in there. No, he didn't remember me. But since that time, he went on, I have become a Christian. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did in there, but I would like to hear it from your lips as well. Fräulein, his hand came out, will you forgive me? And I stood there, I whose sins had every day to be forgiven and could not. Betsy had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out, but to me it seemed hours as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I had ever had to do. For I had to do it. I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition, that we forgive those who have injured us. If you do not forgive men their trespasses, Jesus says, neither will your Father in heaven forgive your trespasses. And still, I stood there with coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Jesus, help me, I prayed silently. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried, with all my heart. For a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then. In conclusion, I'd like to go back to that class on the Holocaust and the question the professor asked. Could you believe in God if you lived through something like that? Could you forgive? How would you have responded if you were faced with this level of persecution? Would my faith be able to withstand that severe test? What if we were one of those stories in the martyr's mirror? Would we be praying for our persecutors? The Nickel Mines school shooting. I have 5 daughters. What if I was one of the fathers that got that call that one of my daughters was killed, was shot? Could I respond in love? And yet there are 2 things that are very clear to me as I sit here and I wrestle with some of those questions. The first is that God is faithful. God will give us the necessary grace and strength to do what he calls us to do or calls us to go through. You know, so many times we look at it from the outside and there's just no way we could ever make it through. I don't know how I would do it. And yet God gives us the grace in that instance of time to do that. He will not let us down. He has never left me down. And there's not a person on the face of this earth that will stand before God on Judgment Day and state that they had no choice or could substantiate a claim that God was not faithful. Not a person around that will be able to do that. And the second thing that's clear to me is that loving one's enemies is one of the clearest pictures that God is alive. We serve a living God. For a person like Corrie ten Boom to forgive a Nazi guard from Robin's book did not come naturally. God is love. He's alive. He's alive within the hearts of many people around the world. For someone to return love when having experienced such extreme hate can only come from the Spirit of God living within them. The bite of the serpent can kill a person. Just like unforgiveness and bitterness has destroyed so many people. Christ bruised the head of the serpent, and he has given us the power, his Spirit, to do the same in situations that arise. So in conclusion, let us purpose to live out the gospel we profess. The Sermon on the Mount wasn't just for 2,000 years ago. It was meant for today. God is alive. It's a love that is not a passive love, but it's an aggressive love. And so let us live that out. Love our enemy as well as our neighbor, and in so doing, clearly point other people to Christ. Well, that's all I have for this evening. Thank you for your time and attention. I know, like I said, what it's like trying to pull a family together and trying to make it here on time, and we were rushing around barely making it on time. So thank you for being here and for your time and attention. Keep praying. I think so many times what we get out of a service is directly proportional to what we put into prayer before the service. Okay, so be in prayer. And look forward to seeing you here tomorrow evening. I would like to end this service. I know we usually stand for a closing prayer. I'd like to end this service with a kneeling prayer. There's something about that posture and relating that to the posture of the heart that I think is so important. So let's kneel for a prayer. That'll be our closing prayer. And then you will be dismissed.